We have some exciting things happening on the podcast here today. First, we have Rachel from Money Hacking Mama. Rachel and her husband heard about financial independence and have been saving and budgeting since. They recently crossed the $650,000 net worth line, and they're racing towards their FIRE goal of $2 million. We're going to talk all about budgeting and some practical ways that Rachel and her husband have been able to achieve their net worth in such a short amount of time. Second, my course, Etsy Printables, and Blogging for Profit, which are two side hustle courses that I last offered back in the summer. I'm opening enrollment once more just this week. So November 14th through November 17th, this is a Thursday through a Sunday. That's when the cart opening and closes. So if you do want to join the course or you missed it last time, then go to firedrillpodcast.com/goldcity to check those out. I teach people how to get started creating their own profitable Etsy shops and how to get started with blogging in a way that you can monetize and make money as a side hustle. Last year, I made $40,000 doing both blogging and Etsy, and that has been a huge help for our financial independence plan. And we've also been able to give a lot to family and do all these fun things with having that extra cash coming into our household. So if you are interested in these side hustles, then definitely check that out. And if you use the firedrillpodcast.com/goldcity link, then you will get some bonuses, particularly from me. You will get my ABCs of blog SEO ebook if you do the blogging one, which gives you the A through Z tips of how to improve your blog search traffic. So my site gets over 100,000 readers every month because of these things that I set up, these SEO things that I do on my blog that helps Google index it and drive more traffic to my site. So that will be helpful to you. And then I'll also give you a link to a video I recorded on how to make a lead magnet. And a lead magnet is something that when you go to someone's blog, you give your email address and you get a little freebie from them. And that's the best way to grow your email list. And if you have a larger email list, then you'll get more readers, capture more readers, you'll be able to spread your message more. And then you also will be able to monetize easier if you have more weight behind your site. So I will send that video out to anyone who purchases through the link that I mentioned. And then on the Etsy side, the two bonuses that I'm giving away are the seasonal product secret. So on Etsy, you can make the most money if you sell seasonal products. And with the holidays coming up, this is a great opportunity to get into this course and take advantage of that. So think about things like Thanksgiving, for example. You could do place cards. You could do printable menus. You could do a schedule for someone who's hosting Thanksgiving to plan out their day. Like, okay, I'm putting the turkey in at 7 a.m. I'm making the pies the day before at 10 p.m. There's so many different printables that you can make that have to do with holidays. And that's kind of the key to making money on Etsy, is that you're making products that people are searching for at the time of the year that they want to search for that. So this ebook is like a 23-page ebook that gives 12 months of printable ideas. So it's like what you should sell in every single month. And if you've been wanting to do the Etsy printable side hustle, but you literally have no idea what you would make, then I hope that this helps you. And I'm also going to give away some other prizes to help you with Etsy too. The first one is a list of over 60 printable ideas that will get you started. And then also I'm going to give you a quick write-up video of how I use eRank, which is this free tool that you can use to improve your Etsy shop listings. And the tool is pretty cool, but there's a lot going on there. So the video will kind of help you sort through it. So if you guys want to get these bonuses, they're only available through people that purchase through this link, firedrillpodcast.com/goldcity. And the window again is November 14th or 17th. Okay, so now on to our interview with Rachel. And you should totally listen if you're still interested in the side hustles, because I learned about Rachel's story because she took my blogging course in July. And that's actually been the coolest part. There are a lot of people that listen to this podcast that ended up taking the blogging course or the Etsy course, and I've gotten to know them through that. So thank you to all of you who supported the podcast back in July. If you've been waiting to get in, now's your chance. And let's go. Let's hear from Rachel.
Welcome to Fire Drill Podcast, where side hustles, savings, and creativity lead to financial independence. With your host, Jay from Millennial Boss.
Hey, Rachel. Thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So let's kick it off by having you introduce yourself.
So my name is Rachel. I'm a somewhat anonymous blogger. I tell you my first name, and that actually is my first name. But I blog at moneyhackingmama.com. But I'm also a wife. I'm a mom to my son. He's about 20 months old. And I work full time in higher education.
So Rachel, when did you first hear about financial independence?
let's see, I bought my house in 2012, and I know it was after that. I think it was 2015. So when I first started working in higher education, I was saving money, and that was, I had a pretty substantial jump in income. I think I was making around $40,000 before that, and then I made around $60,000 when I started working in higher education. And I came across the Mr. Money Mustache article, The Shockingly Simple Math Behind Early Retirement, and I was blown away. And so I did some quick math, and I was like, okay, this could be possible for me and my husband. And we had been users, I think 2012 is when we started using YNAB. And so that was kind of our entree into budgeting and really starting to get intentional with our money. So that was really the foundation that was laid. And then a few years later, when I got a raise, then that blog came along, and I was like, okay, we were intentional with our money, but we had the big goal of traveling. And then we had this huge goal of like, okay, retiring early could be possible. Let's try to do it. And we substantially increased our savings rate, and we were on the track to retire early. And it was really nice too, tracking with YNAB, we were able to see substantial growth really quickly. And so that helped motivate us to continue on the path and continue to save money.
So YNAB, you need a budget. I always was suspicious of things that you had to pay for to budget, but everyone talks about loving this product. What actually is it?
Okay, so I'll talk to you a little bit about how I found out, because I'm the same way as I think most people in the financial independence or just frugal community don't want to pay for an app. And so I got lucky when it first came out. My husband found it on Reddit, and it was a $40 fee for a lifetime subscription. And I was like, that's crazy. How are they going to make money? But well, let's do it. Like $40 forever. Sounds good to me. Sign me up. So we did it. We tried it out, and we had that for many years, just the free version. With YNAB, you're able to track your net worth to the penny instantly. And then you're able to put all your budgeting categories. So it's basically, if you've heard of the envelope system, it's like the envelope system, but rather than having to have cash, which I hate because I'm a credit card churner, you can use your credit cards, you can put all of your accounts, and then it's basically a digital version of the envelope system. And a lot of people compare it to Mint. It's so much more powerful than Mint. And then recently they stopped updating the version that we had, the lifetime version. And so we held on for, I think, a couple of years before we upgraded. The new version does have a lot of cool things. So rather than having to type in all of your expenses, it will pull it down from all of your Chase, all of your bank accounts and things like that. So it makes it much easier and faster. And there is a yearly fee, and that isn't my favorite thing, to be honest, but it's so worth it for me. And it helped us a lot that we were able to get the very inexpensive version for a long time and see the value. So I could see people being hesitant to step in, but I think they have a 21-day free trial. So I would say get in there and give it a shot. And I also know that they have a free version for students, and see if it's helpful to you. And if it helps you save tens of thousands of dollars a year, and you have to pay, I don't know, $100 a year, I don't even think it's that much, it's totally worth it.
How did you guys set your budget categories starting off? So I feel like sometimes I get over eager. I'll be like, oh, we're only going to spend this much here. And then that's totally unrealistic, and we just miss it. And it defeats the purpose of even setting the budget on that.
So not so much the categories, like the name of the categories, but how much goes into each category.
Yeah, like if you said restaurants were $200, how did you set that to make it like realistic, but also work to get you to spend a little less?
So I was a little crazy, and I have a blog post about this because it was the foundation that was laid. So a lot of people forget about everything they're spending money on all year. And most people, they say budgeting and they talk about budgeting for a month. I look at it the other way, and you kind of have to look big picture. So look at what you spend in a year. Like obviously you're going to look at the month. So what are your, you know, your mortgage bill, your cell phone bill, your water bill, those things are pretty consistent month to month. But then you need to zoom out and look at what are your yearly expenses and look back. Like you can take a quarterly view if you use credit cards. How much have you spent on average in restaurants in the past 3 months? And maybe it's $1,000 a month. And you look at that and you're like, oh my God, that's crazy. That's too much. Or maybe it's $300 and you're like, yeah, that's fine. Basically, you got to look at what you're spending money on, everything, big picture, and don't judge it. Just get the data down and then compare that to your income. And if it's more than your income, that's bad because you're spending more than you make and you're going into debt, or you're living paycheck to paycheck. And neither of those things are good for stress management and getting ahead in life, especially if you want to retire early. So then you need to go cut. And I would just say, like, look at all your categories and prioritize. You know, you're going to have your electricity bill and you're going to have eating out. Well, which one's more important to you? Which one do you think would be easier to cut? Maybe when you look at all your budgeting, you find that your water bill is crazy high. And then you look around and you find like a water leak, or you don't have like a water efficient shower, a water efficient toilet. And maybe you can invest a couple hundred dollars and upgrade those and save $50 a month. And, you know, and that's $600 a year. So I think the first thing is just look big picture and don't judge it. And then rather than like squeezing yourself where you don't want to be squeezed, see where you can get creative. Can you change your cell phone provider? Can you get a different quote on your insurance? Things like that. And then the other thing is prioritizing based on your values. So my husband and I looked at it. I think you look at it and you'll be like, oh my gosh, we spent a lot of money on coffee and I don't drink coffee, right? So why am I going there and getting tea when I don't even care about that and I can make it at home? Or you eat out at fast food and it's like, I'd rather spend a little bit more once a month on a nice restaurant than $20 a week on all these fast food restaurants. And it's really not helping me, you know, with my health and fitness goals, with my financial goals. What you spend money on and what your personal and professional goals are, they should be in alignment. And I think if you look big picture, a lot of times they aren't.
So how did this help with your savings rate?
I think when you look a huge picture, you'll realize, I looked at gifts, for example, and all of the holidays, because I looked month to month and I was like, okay, month to month, we should have $2,000 a month to save. And we don't. So where is that money going? And then I looked at the big picture and I said, okay, Christmas time happens and we usually fly to visit family and that costs money. Let's say I spent $100 per person and I was buying like all of my friends and all of my family presents. And I was like, okay, maybe I can't really afford that. If I want to save money, I need to cut that down to like $50 a person. And maybe some of these acquaintances, I mean, this is kind of brutal, but when was the last time this person bought me a gift? And so, okay, maybe I'm going to cut them because they're not really reciprocating. And that's not what gifts are about. If you want to buy somebody a gift, but if, you know, the relationship isn't going both ways, maybe you decide to cut that person off, or you reduce it to $10 and you mail them a card, or, you know, a Starbucks gift card or something like that. So I think it's just looking at your big picture and where is your money going that you don't even notice. Well, most people never do this exercise, and so they never figure that out. But once you figure all those little kind of holes where your money is leaking out, then you can plug them up and you can increase your savings rate.
So the gifts thing is super relevant because we're coming into the holiday season. I think for me, I've always wanted to be that person who was crafty enough to make a homemade gift, or really good at baking and can bake everyone like sourdough bread with like mm-hmm. a really fancy, cute tag. And everyone was like, oh, this is like so much better than some Bath and Body Works lotion that I didn't need or whatever else
right.
people give. But I'm not that person. Have you become that person?
It's funny that you mentioned Bath and Body Works. I'm a couponer at heart. And so I think if I can find gifts, like I bought Bath and Body Works things when they were on sale. And I think one year, one of my coworkers got the little ones. And who knows how much, she probably bought them for full price. I think they're a couple bucks. And then she gave those all out. And I thought that was super cute. And then I went the next year, I don't even remember what time in the year it was, but the big ones were on sale for like $2. So I bought maybe $20 of those and I gave them out to people at my work, but I got 10 for $20 and they were the big ones. So it felt substantial. And that's like a $10 to $12 gift. You know what I mean? So you can tie a little bow on it and that's really fun. But that was honestly the first and probably the last time I did it for my coworkers. So it felt nice and I felt like I wanted to do it that year, but I don't feel like I have to every year. And I think the biggest thing for me that we did for Christmas with my family, we do a gift exchange. So we'll do like $50 to $100 and we all just buy for one person. And that's for kind of our extended family. And then my husband and I set a limit for each other. And now that I have my son, I have stuff in the garage that I think I got at a yard sale or as hand-me-downs from a friend. And he saw them the other day and was looking at him. And I was like, oh, no, buddy, sorry. I'm going to re-gift those as his present. And his grandparents give him tons of gifts. And we have not a huge house, so it just gets super cluttered. And quite frankly, he loves to play with boxes and he loves to get outside and go to the park. So I think people put a lot of pressure behind gifts and they think, oh, people won't think, my kids won't think that I love them if I don't buy them all these things. And maybe that's the case if you have a 13-year-old and they watch TV and they see their friends getting, I don't know, AirPods or something and they don't get them and they feel jealous. But when you have a 20-month-old, like they do not care. So take advantage of that. I don't know, save for their college.
Well, I think you're totally right on that. And funny about Bath and Body Works, I bet they do all their sales in Q4 of the year.
Oh, I bet.
Because it's the perfect gift. It's not that expensive. And as you mentioned, you can hack it. And also, a lot of people like things like that, like lotions and small gifts. It's like a perfect thing. Actually, working at Bath & Body Works is a good side hustle. So when I was in college, I was looking for a seasonal job. And stores like that need people to come in and stock the displays in Q4, like the holiday displays, because they're getting like changed over every week or whatever. And you just go in at night when the store closes and you stock it around and it's like $100 or something. I mean, it felt...
Is it minimum wage or how much?
I don't know how much it was actually. Okay. It felt like $100 to me, but I was also 21. So it could have been like $13 and I was thrilled. It's hard to tell.
Yeah.
But
that's awesome though.
It's a good job for sure. So I've heard in this community, it's somewhat popular to skip Santa. So I don't know what your religious background is or if you celebrate and do Santa, but like with kids. And by the way, if anyone's listening with kids, disclaimer, sorry, just turn this off for them right now. But do you have any thoughts on that? Have you ever heard of that?
So what is skipping Santa where they don't
do Santa? There's no Santa.
There's no Santa.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I'm not super religious, but I plan to do Santa. I think that's a fun thing. I think what I would probably just do what my parents did. So there were some small gifts that came from Santa. And I have heard about this, that if you get the biggest gifts from Santa, how do the kids at school feel? Right. So maybe you are a middle to high income earner. And so you buy your kids, I don't know, a big trampoline or $1,000 gift that's from Santa. And then they go to school and they have some lower income kids or whatever, and they get socks from Santa. So then were the friends the bad kids because they got socks and you got, I don't know, a new TV or something crazy? So I think giving simple gifts from Santa, and then we always, for my family, if there was a big gift, it was more a family gift. So one year we got a big trampoline. And so it was something big that the whole family could use. I have a sister. And so we could all enjoy that and share a bigger gift. We got a ping pong table one year. So it was things my parents enjoyed too. Like we put that in the garage and then we had parties. They would play with that too. So I think from Santa, it's something simple that maybe the kid wants, but it's not super expensive. And then from the family, it's a big shared gift. And then the kid gets a wish list and they can base it off of that. But for my family, I know like on both sides of my family, from my husband's side and my side, there's only one other grandkid. And so they love to spoil the kids at Christmas. So I'm like, we have a small house. I don't want to get too much for my kid. And he's so little, like, I don't know that he'll care that much right now. So yeah, I think Santa fills the stockings, but my son doesn't know yet. So when he's older, I think it's fun. And I like to take pictures with them. And I think Santa is just kind of a special thing that you only get when you're a kid. So I wouldn't want to take that away from them, but I plan to keep it simple.
Yeah. And for me, being so into like magical Harry Potter things, my husband and I really like the show Grimm. I understand that Santa is probably partially for me too, but I love the idea of creating this like magical little realm that she's actually going to believe that it's real.
Exactly. Exactly.
When my Hogwarts letter didn't come when I was 10, I was devastated, but
oh, no.
It was fun to believe that it could happen leading up to that.
Yeah. Sorry, you're a muggle.
Yes, totally a muggle. Oh, it's all the worst. So if anyone wants to hear the other side of Santa, my friend Angela over at Tread Lightly, Retire Early, she has some posts where she's written about it, but it's kind of an interesting perspective because I never heard of people that grew up celebrating Santa deciding they just didn't want to do Santa. And she did it for the reasons that we've kind of discussed, where the whole Christmas thing can be a little bit consumeristic, I guess.
Yeah.
But I'll let her speak to it in her post of exactly why she doesn't do it. But that's interesting that you mentioned that the other kids at school may get more elaborate things from Santa, because I actually experienced that growing up with the Tooth Fairy. The Tooth Fairy, I don't know, like the Tooth Fairy gave me a buck or I don't know what it was, like a quarter or something. And then my friend was like, oh, the Tooth Fairy gave me $5 last night. Yeah. I was like, why does the Tooth Fairy not like me? Are my teeth not like as good or something?
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah. But anyways, beyond that, the holiday season and such, back to your story. So you guys were able to quickly increase your savings rate. I know your savings rate has hovered around 50% for a while, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's amazing. Now, most people are not able to do that by just cutting back on discretionary. They have to make changes in their, like, they call them the big three or whatever, including your housing budget and car and things. Did you have to do that?
So we didn't necessarily have to do that. I'm trying to think back, but I feel like our expenses in those are pretty small. So I'll give you some examples. We bought our house in 2012, and that was at the low, low point of the market, and we got a short sale. So we've almost doubled our equity from our house. And I don't count that in my FI number, but I think our mortgage is $2,000, and we refinanced so that we could have a shorter. So it's only a 15 year. So we have less than, I think, like 12 years left on our house, and we pay about $2,000 a month. And that's also paying extra. So we refinanced out to 15 year mortgage, got, I think our interest rate is like 2.75. So that's super low. And then we pay like $100 extra a month on our mortgage, because my goal is to be able to retire by 40, and I don't want to have a house payment as well. So getting a relatively inexpensive house, like, that was lucky, and also being well prepared. A lot of my friends hadn't been saving money. I lived at home when I was in college, so I saved a bunch of money because I worked. I worked during college. I got scholarships, Fulbright scholarships, so I didn't have debt from college. And then I lived at home, which wasn't the most fun thing. Sometimes me and my mom would bicker. She was going through menopause, and I was a hormonal late teen to early 20-something. But I stuck with it and was able to save a lot of money. So then I moved out and lived in an apartment for like a year. And then our rent kept going up. And so it was just my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband. I was like, we need to look at houses. Like, they seem really low. So we probably looked for like a year. And then we were able to find a house. We put an offer in, and that was kind of risky. So we did, in subject to interior inspection. There was weird stuff going on that we couldn't see the house. So we just put an offer in without seeing it, but there was that fine print in our contract or agreement or offer, I guess. So they called us once they liked our offer, and they said, okay, come look at the house really fast. And we looked, but now in hindsight, I'll go just to look at bigger houses, because it would be nice, especially if we have more kids, to have a bigger house. But I now pay so much detailed attention when I look at houses, and I'm like, no, this isn't right for us. We probably spent 10, 15 minutes like looking through the house that we own now, and the people were home, so it felt awkward. So I didn't open drawers and things like that. And then they accepted our offer, and we bought the house. And it was the best decision we ever made. And we've almost doubled our money in it. So that's amazing. But I just kind of look back and I'm like, that could have gone really bad, potentially. Like, we got lucky with that. But so that's housing. We've saved a lot of money there, and we just haven't upgraded. So our house is like 1,200 square feet. It's nothing huge. It's a 3-bedroom, 2-bath. So if we have another kid, which we're planning on soon, we're probably going to have our kids share a room so that we can still have a guest bedroom and slash office, because we have family that's from out of town. And I look at bigger houses, but then I look at how expensive they are. I'm in Southern California, and the prices are so high that I'm just like, we should probably just stay and wait. If the market comes down, we'll be prepared and we can buy a less expensive house. And if it doesn't, then we'll just be minimalist and try not to have that much stuff. And honestly, that helps with so many things. I wrote a blog post about this too, like this, why I want a bigger house, but why I'm not going to buy one. And I tried to talk about all the things, but we got an energy efficiency thing done, which cost, a couple thousand dollars on our house. But that saves us so much energy. We got new windows. But from an energy perspective, in the summer, again, we're in Southern California, it's hot, but our air conditioning bill is not that high. Our electricity bill isn't that high. Water, heating, like all of those things are so small. But my sister had a huge house when she still lived in California, and her mortgage was expensive. The interest that you're paying is expensive because she had a 30-year loan, and then all of her housing expenses were a lot. And you just have to furnish that because you don't want to walk into an empty house. So you fill the space that you're in. And so our house has been filled, and it almost feels like it's overflowing. I have to get rid of more stuff. And so it's easy to not buy things because I'm like, I don't have anywhere to put it. So that really helps cut down in spending when you keep things really simple and kind of smaller.
I felt the same way, because when we had a baby shower and everyone sent all the gifts, we didn't have any places to put them. So we put them in her nursery before we made it into a nursery. And I almost had a breakdown, honestly, because we have a tiny, tiny house. We were living in a city neighborhood, and there's nowhere. Like, I couldn't step anywhere. We have a massive dog. I felt like the sides of my house were just closing in on me. We've since been able to put things away, and we've gotten rid of even more stuff, which has helped. Mm-hmm. And the idea of like keeping things is just stressful. So we've become even more minimalist than we already were.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And quite frankly, you can sell stuff when things pile up and I'm like, oh, we got to get rid of this. I put on offer up and I make some money. And so it's like, hey, that works.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way. Facebook Marketplace we've used before too.
Yeah.
In our neighborhood, we have all these little library things where people can, like, neighborhood libraries. Have you seen those? They're like stakes and they're little boxes for books. And then you put books in there and you can take other people's books. There's tons of them. Mm-hmm. So I've been putting books in there. And then one day I saw this guy that doesn't live in our neighborhood because he would walk to them, but he was driving to every single one on the street and then the next street over and taking books from there. And I'm like, this guy is probably selling them on Amazon. He's probably got a hustle where he comes to our neighborhood and takes all our good books and leaves bad ones and sells them.
He probably does. Hey, good side hustle, kind of.
I know, right? Like, but oh, man. But you know what? The truth is, I don't need these in my house, so I don't care if he sells them on Amazon. I was exactly. too lazy to sell them myself.
There you go.
Anyways, so you've got a 50% savings rate. In the time from, I think it was, you said 2012 to now, you hit a net worth of, I think, just over 600,000, right?
Yeah, I just checked before this podcast. So we're a little over 650 right now. I think it's hovering around 665. And this is the crazy thing. I track it from year to year. And so with compounding interest, because we have over $500,000 invested, our net worth grows by more than our combined incomes every year. So just think about that for a second.
Insane.
We don't invest 100%. We couldn't because we have expenses, but we're putting in 50% of our income. And then the growth from that 50% plus all the money that we've been saving for the past years all compounds together, and it ends up being more than we actually make. And so that, I look at it every year, and I mean, the market has been doing excellent lately, so that helps, but it just boggles my mind. And I think Einstein said that it's, what is it, the sixth wonder of the world, compounding interest. It truly is. And I think once you get a substantial amount, when you're in debt, that sucks, and interest is working against you. And then if you save, $100, $200, you got to start somewhere. If you put it in a high yield savings account or in the market, it'll go up a little bit. You'll make a dollar a month or, a couple dollars. And that's cool, but that's not substantial. And maybe you can buy coffee with the interest and the money that you're making. So it's exciting to have your money growing, but it's not doing that much for you. But over time, as that grows and your base net worth grows, it just is mind-boggling how much your net worth can grow. And I think about it sometimes, if we wanted to switch, which I don't plan on stopping this high savings rate, but if for some reason we were like, forget it, we're just going to work a little bit longer, we could just stop and let it ride. And as long as we didn't pull that money out, we would still be saving a substantial amount of money, just letting it grow. And then we could, up our lifestyle if we wanted to, which we're completely content with the way it is right now. But if we wanted to, we could, and live this kind of extravagant, more extravagant life now, and also have our net worth grow and probably still be able to retire early, just maybe not at 40, maybe at 50, which is still substantially earlier than most people retire. And some people now, I see all these statistics and, news stories that people aren't even going to be able to retire. And that scares me and worries me. And I'm like, people just need to hear about financial independence and get their savings rate up, because once they do, it's so, so, so powerful.
I think compound interest is so amazing. And a lot of us are just in love with it. We're like, oh man, this is nice. But when you're first starting out, it's so foreign to you. You're like, why do they care so much about compound interest?
Yeah.
Then after years go by and it starts making such a big impact, as you mentioned, it's like, whoa, this is so cool.
It really is. And I love, I think I talk to people that aren't as much of a money nerd as me, and amortization schedules, sometimes people have never heard of that. But if you're in debt, go look at an amortization schedule, just Google it and plug those numbers in, but you'll see how much your debt is costing you. So that's compound interest working against you, but you can see how negatively powerful it is. So if you can just switch it and get on the other side of it, it works the same way, but now it's working to benefit you. And so I think those are things, amortization schedule isn't something that's in most people's vocabulary, the average person. And so those are so valuable, the Networthify calculator, so valuable to look at that and just simply be able to put the numbers in and not have to take a finance class to calculate the future value of something, of your money. But if you can just plug it in an easy online calculator that's so easy to Google, you can really see the power of it. And it works. It's true. There's math and data behind it and people are doing it. But I think people don't even think to Google those things. They're just like, oh, I wanted that thing, so I put it on my credit card and whatever. My minimum payment's $20 a month. It's not that bad. And it's like, no, it's really, really bad. You're paying 25% interest. Go look at the cost, what the true cost of that thing that you bought truly is, if you look at an amortization schedule. And even for your house, look at your amortization schedule for a 30-year loan and just the interest rate. If you could get your interest rate down 1% or just put a little bit extra towards it a month, you'll save hundreds of thousands of dollars potentially, or tens of thousands of dollars. And a lot of people just don't know that. And so I think it's about making big, big moves, thinking creatively about those big expenses and then doing the research behind it, because it can save you so much money, but most people aren't even aware.
One way I like to use the amortization schedule is actually when I'm buying a house, because mm-hmm. I like to see how much debt I think the person has on the house to understand in the negotiation what they would find acceptable. And I remember I first was telling my realtor this in Colorado a few years ago, of like, oh, well, this person I know owes this much on the house. Because you can find like a lot of this information out, and then you can put what type of loan they have into a calculator, as you mentioned. And then you can see about like how many years since they bought it, assuming that most people don't prepay it, exactly how much they owe on the house. And you can say like, okay, well, they're not going to accept any less than this, because with the realtor fee or whatever, they're not going to make a profit. Like, this is probably the good margin, but I may be able to offer a little bit lower because I know that they have a lot. They don't have as much left. Like, they're not like cutting it really close.
Right. So you just make sure there's a little bit of profit for them, but you don't have to like, that's awesome. That's really smart.
Yeah. So I came up with that. But then our realtor was like, no one does that. But, you know, no one does do it, but that's why you should do it.
Exactly. And that's why you get your offer accepted and get a much better deal. Yes. Well, and the realtor doesn't want you to get that good of a deal because they want the higher commission.
Yes. Yep. So that's why I used Redfin I used Redfin selling my house and Redfin buying, and it was a good experience on both ends.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But anyway, so back to the story. So $600,000, you haven't included your house or your car in that. Why haven't you included your house in that?
So our goal is to have $2 million. So that's about $80,000 a year to spend in retirement. And I do think that our plan is to have our house paid off, but then we have to calculate health insurance. And so I'm like, okay, that's kind of a wash. We'll save $2,000 a month because our house will be paid off, but then potentially it could be like $2,000 a month, which I haven't researched a lot of it. And I know I can bring that number down probably as we get closer to it, but I'm not that worried right now. So I'm like, okay, $2,000 a month for health insurance, for a family, like that will kind of be a wash. But your house, you live in it. And so, yeah, it's an asset and it goes towards your net worth, but it's not paying us any money unless we rent a room out or, you know, you do something to monetize it. And so, right, like it doesn't, it's an asset, but unless you sell it or you're renting it or doing something with it to generate income, it's not really helping you in your FI, or that's the way I look at it. And so we need the $80,000. We need $2 million cash to be able to retire by 40. And so our house doesn't matter to me in that number. I am excited because we're getting close to being two commas to hitting 1 million if we do include our house and our cars. So I'll definitely blog about that when it happens within probably the next year. So that's exciting, but it's really just a number and it doesn't help us. What's really going to help us get to FI is that $2 million number and not the number including our house and our net worth.
That makes sense. So you're planning on doing the 4% withdrawal every year.
Exactly.
Got it. Have you been tempted by the people that say you should only withdraw 3% to be more conservative?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I just started this blog, but that's part of the plan is like, okay, if I can get this blog making 40,000 a year within the next 5 years, maybe I could retire then and try to ramp that up, or, you know, other side hustles. So there's all these different options. And quite frankly, me and my husband, we enjoy working, maybe not working full time and reporting to a boss and all the stuff that goes with it and the commute. But if we could be entrepreneurs, and I am super risk adverse, I studied entrepreneurship in college. I love the idea of having a business and I have side hustles all over, but it scares me to just quit my job, especially a job that pays well, has good retirement and vacation benefits and healthcare and all those things. It scares me to quit all that and then just try to be an entrepreneur to make money. And I do realize that part of me, it's like, oh, you know, if you're successful in 5 or 10 years and maybe your blog could make, or your side hustles could make hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you'll kick yourself for not starting it sooner and taking that risk. But it's like, oh, my biggest goal is to hit FI and not have to work if I don't want to, so I can spend more time with my kids. So I feel like the safest way that I know how to get to that is to continue working and saving my money the way I've been doing it. And then once I get to a substantial number that I feel comfortable, then I can quit and have all these side hustles. And then we can withdraw at 3% or 2%. Or again, if we can just let it ride, if I can have $10 million and start flying business class, I'm all for that. But I think my goal is just to get to that 2 million, working some kind of job. And then if I can get it higher and have an even more extravagant life, or, you know, give to charities, like that, there's so many options when you have more money. And so that stuff excites me, but I want to take care of myself and get to that minimum threshold and goal first, and then I'll see where my life takes me after that.
I 100% agree with you because I'm also working in side hustling too. But I've brought a lot of people on the podcast who they believe what you said, where if you are spending all this time in your day job, if you had just focused your energy towards your entrepreneurship, you would probably get a greater return.
Yeah. Well, and your side hustles are killing it. So I am curious, like, do you know when you're planning on?
I don't know.
Like when you'll reach your number? Do you have any like data? Have you looked into projections?
Well, I want to have a super high budget in retirement.
Do you say what it is or no?
I haven't said exactly what it is, but I think right now, like north of 100K per year, okay. Which people are probably like, that's absolutely crazy. So I'm not actually Cody, my partner for the course. He was trying to convince me like, you don't need to live on that much money. And I know, like, I've brought over 200 people on this podcast and I know that you can live on like, you know, 20,000 a year and people are doing it just fine. It's more that I think I'm able to get that. It's not like foreign to me. Like, that's very possible with how everything is going with my day job and my career and all of my entrepreneurship and my side hustles. Like, that is achievable for me. So if it is, then why not? And as you mentioned, like, the more money that you bring in, the more you can help people, the more you can give out, the more impact you can make in some ways. Now, by the way, there's people that are volunteering that are making nothing and they're making way bigger of an impact than me. So that's not what I mean. But it's just easier to make an impact when you have a budget to work with.
Exactly. Yeah. And what I think is funny is it's personal finance. So the first word in that is it's personal. So I think all these people having judgments about anything and everything, personal finance, and it's other people's finances. Like, you can say your opinion, you can try to give people advice and tips and inspire them. But at the end of the day, it's their personal decision. So if they want to have a $5 million a year budget, and I don't know what that, multiply that by 25, was that $1 billion? If that's what their FI number is, then that's what their FI number is. Like, that is what they want to do with their life. More power to them. So it's about, to me, it's personal finance. It's about people making decisions for them and their life. And don't judge people for it. Like, if you want to live on 20 grand a year, by all means, go for it. If you want to live on 120, great, do that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. That's how I feel too. And in this podcast, this is a no judgment podcast. Whatever you want to do in your path to FI, it is totally acceptable here. There's no one size fits all on a very non-mainstream movement. There's no mainstream of a non-mainstream movement. We all can just be whoever we want to be.
I think
I like to spend money in like significant chunks. For example, when we had our baby, we flew my parents and my husband's parents out, and we got them an Airbnb for a whole month. And an Airbnb in Seattle, and even though I negotiated with a bunch of people, it was still just north of $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
Or this summer, I wanted to rent a lake house, and that was multiple $1,000s. It was like Lake Chelan, Washington. So I like to like spend on these extravagant just like chunks, and it doesn't even faze me. So because I have the side hustles and I have my day job.
Yeah.
In the future, I want to be able to do that without having to like worry about that. So I think my FI number is going to be a little bit bigger than other people's who just don't like to spend money in that fashion.
Yeah. To me, you know what your values are, you know what is important to you, and you know how much it's cost, and you're working towards it. Like, those are all the things that you need to do. And that's perfect.
Yeah. So that's kind of my jam. But I think we all got our own flavors. But let's talk about how we actually met each other, sort of, offline. So you took the Blogging for Profit course and the Etsy Printables course when it opened up this summer. And it's been really cool to meet everyone in the financial independence community and listeners of the podcast that have wanted to start blogs. And now I know a lot more about their own stories, and it's been really cool. So I've been really enjoying having you in the course. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. It's been so much fun for me as well. And this is part of the reason why I bought, I have to say, is that I wanted to know who you were because you were anonymous.
Well, I guess everyone knows who I am now because I came out as a person.
Yeah.
Can you describe, like, why did you decide, especially with blogging, why did you decide after following Financial Independence podcasts and blogs for a while, why did you decide that you wanted to participate yourself?
I've always been passionate about money. And I think most people in the financial independence community are, like, they're money nerds. They Google random things about money and try to figure it out. So I've always done that. And then when you figure really cool stuff out that nobody else is talking about, you want to share it with people. So years ago, I used to work for a financial planner. And there were things that I liked about that and things that I didn't. But there was a lot of just stuff that I was learning that I thought people should know about. So I started a blog and it went nowhere. And it really stressed me out. And like, the longer I would stay off of WordPress and not update it, the more stress I would get because I would forget how to even maneuver inside of WordPress. And then it would just get longer and longer. And eventually I would go back in there and I would spend so much time and not really do anything. And I think in a span of multiple years, I probably only had like maybe 10 posts. And I think I almost had that in my first month blogging once I bought the course through you. So I just had a miserable experience, quite frankly. Like I learned a lot trying to do it myself, but DIY with blogging is just exhausting. Like I don't have a web development background. I'm not an IT person. I do have a business background, but there's just so much you need to learn. And it can take forever if you're trying to put all the pieces together and watch YouTube videos and read other blogs. And you're just going down this rabbit hole of learning without actually doing things. And so I've always had that passion. And actually, it's a funny story. So I was cleaning out my office in my house and I had all these goals and like planners, notes and lists and to-do and action items that were written down for when I had my blog. And there were such beautiful, inspiring goals. And I looked at it and I almost cried. I didn't. I'm not that much of a crier, but I looked at it and I was like, oh, these are my dreams and they went nowhere. What am I doing with my life? I started that and that's a good thing, but it went nowhere. And where would I be if I kept with it? You know, because now it'd been 5 years or something since I started the blog, but I probably only did it for a couple months and then I just let it sit up there. And then eventually it got turned off because I didn't upgrade the hosting and pay for the domain name anymore. So it just went away. And so it was just luck or serendipity. I've been an avid listener of your blog and then you started talking about your courses and I was like, wow, I really don't have time to do this, but it's not that expensive. And what I don't have time to do is the way I did it last time. And I don't have the energy to do that either. So I need to just suck it up and pay some money to have somebody help me. And so that was what I decided to do. And I'm so, so happy that I did it.
You definitely completely crushed it too. I remember the first month you were just like plowing through all the assignments and we definitely were like, wow, like Rachel is on a mission. So kudos to you for that. That's pretty cool.
So it's actually a funny story. I'm a student. We get tuition remission where I work. It was the summer still when I started the course. And so I had August to get as much stuff done that I could in the beginning before school started. So I was just trying to hustle as hard as I could to get everything set up. I figured I can blog and write articles and market my articles once I have everything set up, but when school is going. But before school started, I wanted to just make sure I got everything, the base website and all that stuff figured out before school started. So that was why I was really trying to go as fast and hard as I could that first month.
Now, a lot of new bloggers, when they join our course, the technical stuff is very helpful because we're taking you from how to go from scratch to creating a blog and then how to profit. And I talk about all the different strategies that I use and you can just kind of copy those if you'd like. But I know that you've also connected and made some connections with other bloggers within the course. And I know for me, the most rewarding part of blogging has been connecting. Have you found that to be true?
Oh my gosh, yes. One of the things you guys talk about is it's important to get guest posts. And so I found just the community of people to get guest posts for your own blog and to get guest posts on your blog and to really just get to know those people, because it feels funny if you're going out and like reaching out to other bloggers and you have no idea who they are. So you get a safe space to practice with the other people that are new and you kind of understand what it feels like for them, what it feels like for you. And maybe they're a year into it or a few months or things like that. And you can all help each other out. And it's just so much fun and it's rewarding. And honestly, I think that's part of the reason why I wasn't as successful the first time years ago when I tried this, because I was doing it all alone and I didn't have anybody to say like, yeah, guys, look what I did. And they would, you know, pat me on the back for it. And other people, and I was like, oh man, this is what I'm struggling with. And they would be like, yeah, me too, but here's the solution or here's what I found. So that community is so powerful and it just encourages you to keep going. And then when you see other people that are in similar situation as you get something, it just makes it feel more possible. So if somebody gets on a podcast, it's not as scary or like, and then you can just go and ask them, be like, how'd you do that? And they might be like, oh, here's the contact information and just email them or I'll send them an email and introduce you. So it just makes things so much easier.
You also took the Etsy printables course too. Why did you do that? And also, how do you compare the two different side hustles? Like if someone is not sure whether they're interested in Etsy or blogging, what would you say as pros to each one and cons to each one?
Okay, pros and cons. That was a lot of questions in one question, but pros and cons. So, and why I chose both of them, I guess. So blogging, I think I always wanted to do it. And that's kind of, again, I looked in my notes and that's kind of a goal and dream of mine. So I wanted to make sure that I saw that this was a possibility and this was a tool to get where I wanted to go. And so I was like, okay, let's do it. And I sent you an email because Etsy I saw as fast and fairly simple because it's a platform that already exists. You don't have to build all that. So all you have to build really is the products and then market them. So I saw that as easy and some quick wins. And then you can learn about marketing. And I like Canva and I like creating stuff. So I was like, okay, that I feel like I can make money quickly and easily. And it can be this like side business, like the printables is super easy. You make it once, you market it a little bit, and then it's up there forever. And you could, you know, you get mailbox money, as they say, or email box money. So that was really fun. And I spent July again. I bought these during the summer. So I did July. I just got my Etsy shop up and running. And then I started the blogging course in August and got that up and running. So Etsy is like quick wins, but I don't think you're going to get like this huge amount of money. It's possible. Like I've seen these huge shops that have tens of thousands of downloads, but I'm not a graphic designer at heart. And I'm not going to spend hours a day creating products. I just wanted to create some fun stuff because I enjoy it almost as a hobby. And then if I can monetize it, great. So that was kind of a cool thing to put on the side. And then the blogging, I feel like the money potential is much higher. But for me, I think it takes longer. And so you can be an influencer and you can have a platform that you can leverage. I mean, you could probably sell an Etsy shop, but I think you can really sell a blog if you wanted to once you have enough of a following on that. Not that I plan to with mine, but there's just so much power. Like you see, I think you, your income reports, Julie, like you're making tens of thousands of dollars a year, like almost a full-time income with your blog. Whereas Etsy shops, you can probably make thousands of dollars, but it might not be like a full-time income. It could be, but maybe not as much. So I think that's kind of the trade-off, this quick win where you can do something that's not as complicated and there's all these tools and resources for you that are already built in. That's Etsy. And then the blog is more like you have to manage it and you're creating this whole business. You're creating your site from scratch most of the time. And so you have a lot more decisions you have to make. But then to me, that's fun as well because you have the power behind it and you can really do with it what you want and you own it. And that's another thing, like Etsy, they just changed the way that their ads work. And that was kind of frustrating. And so you don't have control over where like with blogging, yeah, like Google can change the way the SEO works, but you still own your blog and you can manage that and you can leverage the different tools in different ways as you please.
That's exactly how I feel about it too. Whereas Etsy, it's a quick win. If you're doing this as a side hustle, you're probably not going to make $1 million, but it's very creative and it's very fun and it's low maintenance. So mm-hmm. I put up literally one listing. I was recording a new video for the course and I made a listing and I get thousands of dollars a year based on things that I made last year over mm-hmm. a couple weekends. So you can just kind of like leave it and let it sit. Blogging, you have to push it forward. You have to like keep the ball rolling every single week if you want to really grow, but you have the potential to make a lot more money.
Exactly.
So let's talk about, to close us off, just give nods to your shop and your blog. So I see that you have over 60 something sales in your Etsy shop already, Prosperous mm-hmm. Printables. That's really amazing. And you do a lot of like budgeting and finance stuff. And it looks like you've recently moved into wall art.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's really fun. And it's funny, the wall art has kind of been taking off. I've just been trying to find like little niches there where there's not a lot of competition, but it seems like people are interested. And I've been really into figuring out the Pinterest marketing strategy more so for my blog. But while I'm learning more of that, I'm really thinking I need to leverage that more for my printables page, my Etsy page. And so I'm excited to test out some of those strategies in the next couple of months and see if I can get my Etsy shop to grow. Because I've left that alone pretty much since the end of July and it's still been growing and getting sales. So that's been exciting to see.
Yeah, I love getting those cha-chings on my phone. Cha-ching, another sale.
Yeah, exactly.
And your blog is moneyhackingmama.com and you talk about your financial independence journey and a bunch of stuff, but I'll let you kind of describe it.
Yeah. So I try to do money hacks for savvy mamas, but anybody can come on there. I actually have a lot of men, surprisingly, which I'm like, I'm building this for women and moms. And then all these guys are coming on, but hey, more power to them. But yeah, I'm chronicling my personal finance journey. Part of that, I'm chronicling my blog journey. So if people are thinking about starting a blog, I've talked about my first few months, what I've done in those months. I try to have a gratitude list, but I think it is helpful because you could go on there and look at what I'm grateful for and what I've done. And you could just duplicate a lot of that stuff and say like, oh, there's a laundry list of everything she did this month. Like if you want to start a blog, you can do that. But just know that if you don't know how to do those things, everything that's listed, I pretty much learned in Julie's course. So take the course if you don't know how to do any of those.
I want to mention that if you are someone that loves reading blogs that share numbers, Rachel gives her net worth report every quarter where she gives all of her numbers. So if you're into numbers, check out her blog.
Yeah. And I'm really excited. Like I said, soonish, within the next year, I think we'll hit the $1 million mark. And so I'll give a breakdown on those numbers as well and where everything is filling in. But I'm excited to do an end of year, a quarterly update in just a couple of months.
Cool. Yay. All right. So we're at the final two, the last two questions. Rachel, if people want to connect with you, where can they find you?
So they can find me at moneyhackingmama.com. We talked a lot about different articles. So if they go to moneyhackingmama.com/firedrill, I'll put together some stuff that we talked about on this post that they can take a look at that I think they'd be interested in based on our conversation. And I'm also on Instagram. That's probably the platform I use the most, but it's just at moneyhackingmama. And please, if you want to email me, it's mama@moneyhackingmama.com. So I'd love to chat with you. I'm a real human and I don't have tons of people looking at my site. So I have the time to have real conversations with people. So send me an email.
Very cool. And last question, what is your wildest dream?
My wildest dream is to retire early to help 1 million people with their personal finances. And I would love to travel the world with my family and spread the word about personal finance.
Love it. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Thank you so much for having me. It's been so much fun.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Go to our website, firedrillpodcast.com, to continue the discussion and get the link to our private Facebook group.